Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. Glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. Each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com, that's annliguori.com, and distributed on my podcast on Audio Boom and iTunes. Well, this morning, I'd like to introduce you to a guy who put the Golf Channel on the map in the cable network's early days and months before the cable network even existed. Michael Whalen was the genius behind the production and programming of the 24/7 channel devoted to the sport of golf. Every person hired, every show created, the sets, the music, the graphics were developed in his mind months before the channel went on the air on January 17, 1995. Michael and I have been friends for years, and having worked with Michael doing various jobs in the early days of my career when he worked at HBO Sports, I did everything from being a production assistant for heavyweight boxing bouts for HBO Sports to working as a statistician at Wimbledon and the U.S. Open Tennis Championships when HBO Sports had the rights to those mega events. I saw firsthand Michael's talents in production. And then when he called me a few months before the Golf Channel became a reality, asking me if I would create and host a weekly primetime show for the Golf Channel, I actually had the opportunity to work with him firsthand in production and in programming and witness all the work and innovation that went into the channel's creation from the beginning. You know, Michael and I reconnected a few years back after decades of really not being in touch. And I have since learned that Michael has dealt with mental illness issues all of his life, in addition to the fact that he has been fighting cancer like a warrior since the COVID days. Michael has been quite open about all of this, sharing his journey on social media, on X, at Michael J. Whalen, that's W-H-E-L-A-N. And you will be inspired by his candidness and his fight, not only for his own health issues, but in educating others about mental illness. And you know, the golf world suffered a huge tragedy when PGA Tour pro Grayson Murray, who had been suffering with depression and alcoholism and seemed to be on the rebound in a positive way, took his own life not long after he withdrew from the 2024 PGA Tour event at Colonial Country Club in Texas with two holes left in the second round. He withdrew from the tournament. And it was the next morning when news of his passing took the entire industry by shock. I mean, just heartbreaking. 30 years old, Grayson Murray, he had won twice on the PGA Tour and had played in the Masters for the first time in April of 2024. And he had moved to Palm Beach Gardens in Florida with his fiance. And his parents said, in quotes, "Life was not always easy for Grayson. And although he took his own life, we know he rests peacefully now," end of quote. Earlier this year, Grayson spoke of going through recovery from alcohol abuse and how he had put his parents through so much. And then after he won the Sony Open in Hawaii in January of 2024, you know, he said that his story is not finished. He said, in quotes, "I think it's just the beginning. I hope I can inspire a lot of people going forward that have their own issues," end of quote. So many people have expressed very emotional responses to his suicide. And I certainly pass along prayers and condolences to the family and the PGA Tour family. It's just so very sad, so very tragic. Michael knows about these battles and often encourages those who are battling any kind of mental health issues to reach out. It was just an absolute pleasure to catch up with Michael Whalen. I pray that he recovers fully and can continue to be an inspiration and guide for others. Welcome back to the show. And, you know, I've known my next guest, Michael Whalen, for a very long time. Former TV programming and production whiz, Michael was the architect for the Golf Channel, the genius behind the production and programming. He's a mental health advocate. He's been battling cancer now for years. We'll learn all about that. All documented on his very active social media account on X. Michael Whalen, it's been too long. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, my dear friend, Ann. How are you today?
I'm doing well. You know, you and I have known each other for a very long time in the broadcasting world. I'm trying to remember when we first met. I think one of my earliest gigs was working Wimbledon as a statistician for HBO Sports. And you were obviously at HBO Sports for a very, very long time. Do you remember the very first time we met?
You know what? I think it's even earlier than that. I think I actually hired you as a production assistant back in the 80s for a Michael Doats, Jerry Coetzee boxing match in Cleveland, Ohio.
I think you're right. Wow. Great memory.
Yeah. Yeah. My mind is full of all this useful information, but I think somehow, and I'm not quite sure, I think it was your probably persistence of reaching out to me, but I think the first time that we actually got together was for the pugilistic battle in Cleveland. And ever since then, you've been, you were part of my life. You were part of HBO's life. You were instrumental in those great shows that we did. And you have done nothing but skyrocketed up for the last 30 plus years.
Well, thank you very much for saying that, Michael. When, you know, you said Cleveland, I was, you know, raised in Brecksville, Ohio. So that really makes sense going back from New York to Cleveland and you know, doing some production gigs for HBO Sports. But let's talk about your career in the early days. You had some really major jobs in the business as a young man.
Yeah, I was very fortunate. How it's really strange how I got into the television business. I never dreamt of it happening. I actually went to New York back in the early 80s thinking that I was going to become a doctor. And I happened to run into a television wizard back then by the name of Terry O'Neill, who ran CBS for many, many years, who was a good friend of my father, who happened to be with the New York Knicks at the time. And we hit it off, and he said, you know, Michael, if you ever decide not to be a doctor and you want to go into television, give me a call. And in about a week or two, I was knocking on his door and disowned by my family for a few years, thinking that I had lost my mind. But things actually kind of worked out the way that they were supposed to.
I remember Terry O'Neill. He was the executive producer at CBS Sports, and that was my first job out of college back in 1982, working as a freelance, whatever, production assistant. That was probably too glamorous of a title for what I did back then. But so you started with Terry O'Neill. Well, tell me about your first jobs.
My first jobs were, I think I joined CBS about the same time that John Madden did. And I did mostly a lot of their NFL football, you know, either the A or the B games. Mike Arnold, who is now one of the most prolific directors in the history of television. We were all kind of there at the same time. Did a lot of skiing, gymnastics. I mean, there was just a myriad of sports that CBS did at the time. I think, though, that back in the 1980s, I was a little immature and unprepared for the industry, and it lasted for about a year or two at CBS. And they gave me my pink slip and said, television probably isn't for you. And a few weeks later, not knowing what I was going to do, I got a call from HBO asking me if I wanted to do a 14-day show for them. It was a Marvin Hagler championship fight. and I stayed there for almost 14 years.
With Ross Greenberg, right? At HBO?
Yeah, Ross Greenberg. Well, at the time, Ross was the executive producer. A gentleman by the name of Seth Abraham was the president of HBO back then. And it was pretty much Ross, Rick Bernstein, and myself were the three amigos in that order, obviously. And I couldn't have worked at a better place. Mentored by two tremendous producers, storytellers, and HBO really gave me the blueprint to learn how to become an interesting writer, a director, a producer, working on some of the greatest shows. You mentioned Wimbledon tennis, boxing, gymnastics, figure skating. And we were known back then, and we sort of created, everybody takes for granted all of the documentaries that you see today, whether it's Full Swing or anything. But HBO was doing this back in the 80s before anybody else. And we were blessed because we had no commercial interruption. So everything that we did was really a mini movie. And all of my skills I credit to Ross and to Rick.
Really good people, as well as just wizards in production. And HBO, they had the rights to the US Open Tennis Championships because that was my first job covering the US
Yep.
Open Tennis as a statistician. And then I did the same job at Wimbledon, really keeping score, telling the Chiron operator what to put on the screen. Gosh, if I missed a point, then the whole country was getting the wrong score. But those were very exciting times in my career in my early days. And boy, Michael, that was a great opportunity for you. So you were able to do so much, as you say, for a cable network in its infancy that was so innovative.
I was, and I just so happened to be at the right place at the right time. HBO, I mean, people forget that back in the 80s, there was only what, three or four channels that were on. HBO was a must-see TV destination almost every week. But yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate to be around a lot of great people. We did some of the best events in the world. I mean, remember back in the 80s, I mean, got working with Arthur Ashe and Billie Jean King and Barry Tompkins and Jim Lampley and John Lloyd and Chrissy. And well, I mean, we just had a great group of people that made those shows absolutely fantastic. I mean, we would go on for 4 or 5 hours every single day for 2 weeks leading up to NBC's finals for the men's and women's, and we did that for 14 years.
So tell me about the Golf Channel. You were hired before the Golf Channel was even on the air.
Yeah, I mean, that's most people, you know, the biggest mystery of the world is one, who was really responsible for building the pyramids in Egypt, or who helped create the Golf Channel? Two questions that have never been answered. But in 1993, I got pulled aside by one of our HBO executives, Bob Greenway. And Bob was in charge of all of our programming. Bob was the one who got the shows, paid for them, negotiated them. But Bob also was a closet production guy. He really, I think, would have liked to have been the vice president of production. But out of the blue one day, Bob just pulled me aside. It was a snowy, rainy day in New York. And he said, I think I have something that you might be interested in. I can't share it with you today, but something is happening, and I'll get back to you. It was very cryptic, no information. I couldn't get anything out of it. At the time, I kind of thought Bob was probably offered a job at ABC, NBC, or CBS and was going to take me along. When the time came, He said that I have been offered the job as the senior vice president of production and programming of a new show called The Golf Channel. At first, I thought he said the Golf Channel, like the water. So I thought he
Like
was going like to the,
GULF.
yeah, I thought he was going to the Weather Channel or something. But he said no, there's a gentleman in Birmingham, Alabama, by the name of Joe Gibbs, who has partnered with Arnold Palmer. They've raised $70 million, and they've got this idea of doing a 365, 24/7 golf network. And he said, of all the people at the golf ch at HBO, I think that you would be perfect to create the network. Is it something that you would like to do? Obviously, being third in line at HBO, very few people in their lifetime will ever get an opportunity to put their thumbprint on an entire network. So, as I looked at the snow falling on a 30-degree day in New York City, I said, let's do it. So, Bob hired me. I became the a vice president of production and programming and executive producer. And after doing my last Wimbledon, after flying to Vegas to do my last boxing, I then went home, packed up my house, and went to Orlando. And I walked into a room with a white board and had not hired one person, had not, I created actually the entire network on a cocktail napkin flying to Wimbledon. But then I had about, well, I arrived in July, so it's August, September, October, November. I had 6 months to put together an entire network.
And
And then I,
what year was that,
that was,
Michael?
that was, that was in, that was in the end of June, July of 1994. And at the same time, there was another network being created, and that was Fox News. And Fox News had about $3 billion between Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes. The Golf Channel had about $1.50 in some spit and chewing gum. And Joe said, I need to go on in January of 1995. So within a couple of months, I hired over 100 people. I created over 20 shows. I built all the sets. I composed and did all the music. I did the sets. It was just a 24/7 job of trying to get convince people to come on down to Orlando. So I was probably for a couple of months not only the most powerful person in sports, but also the most hated, because every network knew that I was pillaging people from their network and convincing them that this 24-hour golf channel was going to make it. And lo and behold, we did it.
I'll never forget that day you called me. I was in my office in Manhattan on 49th Street running Ann Liguori Productions, and I was hosting Hey Liguori, What's the Story on WFAN. I was doing my other show, Sports Interview, which I was hosting, booking the guests for, getting the sponsors for, syndicating it, promoting it. I mean, you name it. It was like a one-woman show. And you said, hey, there's this new channel that's going to be going on the air soon, called the Golf Channel, and let's come up with a show that you can do, Anne. And I think in about 5 or 10 minutes on the phone, after I asked you what other shows you already had in the works, I think we came up with, all right, let me interview celebrities who are not professional golfers who have a passion for golf. And I promised you I would get A-list guests. Of course, I had no idea how I was going to do it. But
Well,
you greenlighted that baby, and the next thing you know, Conversations with Anne Liguori was on the air.
I go back to that flight between New York and London, when I did my last Wimbledon, and I spent that 7-hour flight drafting what I wanted to be the entire production and programming framework of the Golf Channel. And one of the big things that I wanted to do was I felt that it was imperative that we change the landscape of what golf used to be. Most people don't remember before 1994, but golf was a very, very different sport. And what we saw on TV was very homogenous. It was a bunch of old white guys talking about sports. There were very few women. There were very few people of color. And coming from HBO, I came from a more diversified world of creative men and women, black and white, gay and straight. And I had I knew that it was important that when we went on the air, that we represented the entire social way that the world looked. I remember sitting in meetings with the other executives, mostly from Alabama at the time, and here was this California, New York hotshot executives. And I know that most of them thought that I was absolutely crazy and had lost my mind. Fighting for a lot of these shows was really hard. It wasn't easy. But I knew that we had to have someone like you on the show. I knew that we had to have an African American host, which was Dwayne Ballen back at the time. And I also hired a gentleman by the name of Peter Kessler, who had never, ever been on television. And I made him the franchise of the Golf Channel. And lo and behold, my beliefs came true. And from you to Peter to Dwayne and all of the other women and men, it was just a perfect symphony of people that did a fabulous job, because I knew that when the lights went on, when we launched the channel in 95, that we were only going to have one chance to make an impression, not just on the viewers, but all of the sponsors and people that were going to put money into this network. And I made people do a lot of different things that they were used to doing. But I wanted the network to look more like HBO than it was going to be a local television product. And we did it. And 30 some years later, it's a multi-billion dollar business.
Absolutely. What a success story, Michael Whalen, that you are so big a part of. As I said, the programming production whiz that you were back then. And what were those early days like? I mean, you had Arnold Palmer as one of the founders. You said you hired Peter Kessler. He had the mellifluous tones of Peter Kessler, right? I remember when, the launch party in 95, and Joe Gibbs and Arnold Palmer kind of pulling down that huge switch in the studio. It had been one of the most exciting ventures I'd ever been a part of. And when I look back at my career, Michael, I was one of the freelance writers in the early days of USA Today, which was a brand new concept in the print world. I was the first woman to host a show on WFAN, which was the first all sports radio station, and the first woman to host a primetime show on the Golf Channel, which was really one of the first niche channels, right? So
I'm going to interrupt you for a second. I think it's even bigger than that, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I think you might have been the first female host ever to host any show in prime time. I
wow.
think it was bigger than the Golf Channel. I don't think anybody had a female host at CBS, NBC, ABC, ESPN. I don't think it existed at the time. So, when I sat in these meetings with Joe and Bob and told them what I wanted to do, boy, oh boy, there was a lot of shaking their heads. And but you know what? My instincts have almost always been right when it comes to the production part of it. I knew you would be good. I knew all these people that I brought in were going to be good. I just felt it. And we were very lucky, you know, that all that stuff with Joe Gibbs and Arnold Palmer pulling down all that hocus pocus PR stuff. I wasn't even around there. Up until we went on the air, I was screwing in light bulbs and I was vacuuming and I was making sure the sets looked fine. And I had more things to worry about than the PR party before the show. And everybody rose and took their game to another level, from you to everybody else. The Golf Channel just looked top notch. It looked like it had been around for a long time. Out of the 101 people I hired, I'd say 99% of them were great choices. Some people are still there, most are not, but there's still a few that are. Rich Lerner is still there. I don't know if anybody else is. There might be a few technical people, but it was an exciting time. It was great. It was fun in a frantic way. It was not easy. It took a big toll out of my life. It caused a lot of mental health issues for me, but it was worth it. I mean, it's something that will be there probably forever. And now we take for granted all of the shows that are on TV, that are on cable, that are on streaming, the way documentaries look, the way golf is produced. But there was a time when that just didn't happen. And I'm honored and privileged that they gave me an opportunity. And we all rose to the occasion.
I mean, what a splash it made, because you're right. You know, it didn't take years for the programming to go, kind of grow into really excellent programming. It started with a bang, right? Boom, the programming, the Golf Channel was on the air. And the programming back then was com so compelling. I think, honestly, I have to say, those have to be the glory years. Not just because of conversations with Alan Gorey. I'm putting myself out of it. I know it, I probably can sound very like subjective here. But the other shows that were created were they were all just so very compelling and really the highlight of the channel. Of course, my show ran for 6 years, every Wednesday night, prime time. And I did get, I got Joe Pesci, I got Kevin Costner, Sylvester Stallone, boy, Sugar Ray Leonard, Jim Brown, Vince Gill, Amy Grant, Matthew McConaughey, Celine Dion. I mean, I did deliver what I promised to get an A-list group of stars. I remember David Fo Faraday's producer years later calling me and asking me, how did I get those guests for a show? The show that was on in the
Yeah.
very, very early days of the Golf Channel. Because here was the problem in the early days of the Golf Channel, Michael. A lot of cable systems around the country, it took cable systems such as Cablevision on Long Island at least 7 or 8 years before they even carried the Golf Channel. So by the time a lot of these cable systems carried, you know, the Golf Channel and had my show was only what aired the first 6 years. So that's when I decided to put all these interviews from that show into a book, and that was my first book, A Passion for Golf: Celebrity Musings About the Game. But and then, you know, my show went the wayside of infomercials. Remember? I mean, there the whole infomercial stage, which was sad, really, in the
there,
history of the channel.
yeah, there, there was definitely a they changed the whole philosophy of what the Golf Channel would become. When I took that flight from JFK to Heathrow in London, the first thing that I wrote on my notes was intimacy. And from intimacy, what I meant was I wanted people every single night to turn on the Golf Channel because what they were going to see was something that they could only dream of. I mean, it was going to be Golf Talk Live, where people could not just see Peter interviewing Arnold Palmer, but they could call in and talk to Arnold Palmer. We'd have Jim McClain's, Jim Flick's, some of the greatest instructors in the world, not just giving you lessons, but you can call in and talk to them. Golf Channel Workshop, Viewers Forum. What I wanted, I brought the old school of Larry King days, Larry King on the radio. Hello, this is Larry King. You're speaking to Larry. I wanted that to be for the Golf Channel. And, there was some feedback. Would it work? Would it not work? But I thought that if we could make this a place where it could be the 19th hole, where men and women who love the game could talk to the greatest people who were responsible, not just to playing it, but writing about it and building the courses and giving the lessons. And I think those, as you said, those interesting, compelling shows that people could relate to, it became must-see TV almost every single night. And the sponsors absolutely loved it. I didn't last very long. I stayed there for about 4.5 years. But then the philosophy just changed. It changed from programming to infomercials, and sooner than later, a lot of these shows were replaced by different types of programming. And that just happens in sports television. You bring in new people, you look at different ways of financing, of bringing in revenue. And those types of shows that you produced and so many others just fell by the wayside. I mean, there's an incredible library of 1995 to 2000 of shows that you could probably start a Golf Channel 2. I'm going to give them the idea, but my first year, I went into Joe Gibbs and to Bob Greenway, and I said, I want to create our version of the ESPYs. I want it to be the Arnies. Why not celebrate every single year, just like the ESPYs or the Academy Awards or the Grammys, the greatest feats of golf? It's never been on the air since. In 1995, I said, I got this idea. Is there a way that we can simulcast our Golf Central news show on the radio? Oh, what are you on the radio? What? Why would people listen to sports on the radio? So I was just a little bit ahead of my time. I was kind of the John Nash from A Beautiful Mind, a creative genius that was maybe a little bit over the edge and eccentric. But today, all these things that we watch and all these things that we listen to are all taken for granted. I miss the old Golf Channel. There are a few people that have remained who are fabulous, but it just doesn't have that the intimacy of the love of the game like it once did. And a lot of that has to do with there was no social media in 1994. There was no trolls. There weren't thousands of people to bash Brandel Chamblee or Rich Lerner or, God knows if there was social media, they would have ripped you and I apart. It's a thank God we did it at a time when it was a safe place to put on these great shows that we had ideas for.
We're talking to Michael Whalen, former programming architect for the Golf Channel. We'll be back with Michael right after this. Welcome back to the show, and we are back with Michael Whalen, original architect of the Golf Channel. He is a mental health advocate, and Michael has been battling cancer for a long time now. So I'm sure Michael will share a little bit about that journey as well. But Michael, it's just so great to reconnect with you after all these years. And you said when you were putting the Golf Channel together in the early days of the Golf Channel, I can just imagine it was 24/7 work, 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 a lot of pressure on you, a lot of expectations on yourself and that you ran into some mental health issues. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think it's probably more accurate to say I never ran into them. They were always with me, and the Golf Channel might have exacerbated what had already existed. I think, you know, it's very common to know that a lot of artists, and it doesn't mean if it matter if you're a painter, a guitar player, a dancer, a lot of our brilliance and a lot of our creativity is comes from a place of pain. It comes from a place of emotions that we're able to tap into. And for as long as I can ever remember, and this goes back probably 60 years, I know that I've never felt the way other boys and girls did. I always knew that there was something a little bit off about me. I always knew that I was had a lot of sadness, and my highs were very high and almost manic. You know, talking about putting together the Golf Channel on a cocktail napkin on my way from JFK to London, I was probably more in a manic state during that 7-hour flight, just writing things down left and right and coming up with ideas. But I think the Golf Channel just kind of let the cat out of the bag. You know, I never let anybody know. I mean, back in the 90s, if you told anybody that you had, I mean, you think Joe Gibbs, Bob Greene would have hired me if I said, oh yeah, I'd love to run your network and the $70 million. But I just want to let you know, I also suffer from bipolar disorder. I would have lost that job and any opportunity right away. Back before, you know, 2020, 2015, anyone with mental health disorders was given a scarlet letter, ostracized, and told to go stay in their corner. So the Golf Channel was tremendous pressure. I mean, most people don't realize they see the brilliance and they see the production and they see the shows, but they also don't understand that, you know, I had 6 months to save Joe Gibbs and everybody else who had invested $1 million in this idea. I also had convinced 100 people to leave what they were doing, give up their jobs, move their families, and that the Golf Channel was going to work. So every day, you know, I didn't know if we were going to even be able to make payroll. You know, there was days when we didn't know if we even had enough money in the coffer to pay people. So yeah, I mean, you know, could I put together a 24-hour network? You know, there was days when I wasn't sure. But, you know, I certainly wasn't going to share those fears with anybody else. You know, I was just on the go 24/7. I wasn't resting. And, you know, the depression and the manic stages just got to a part where after a few years, when everything kind of settled and the channel took off, I think I started to realize that I had some very serious issues, but there was no HR department. There was no mental health department. I tried to mask it as long as I could, and I didn't do a very good job at the end with it.
So after your tenure with the Golf Channel ended, it wasn't that long, you said for some years, what was your outlet for your creativity? What did you do?
I didn't do a lot for a while. I really became a recluse. I became shameful. I became embarrassed. I became sad. I became, I lost my confidence. And so I spent most of my days hiding in my house alone. When I was at the Golf Channel, my phone never stopped ringing. People never stopped inviting me to play golf, to have dinner. And when the Golf Channel and I parted our ways, the music stopped playing very, very quickly. There was accusations that I left based on improprieties that, look, when the Golf Channel launched back in 1993, 94, it was a different time in the world. The thing about the Golf Channel is, bringing in 100 people from around the world, we were the only people we knew. We did everything together. We worked together. We hung out together. We drank together. We dated. Some people even got married from the Golf Channel. We didn't know anybody else in Orlando, Florida. We had nowhere else to go but to hang out. And so when I left the Golf Channel, I was really lost in Orlando, Florida. I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know if I wanted to stay in the business. And so the worst thing that anybody with mental health can ever do is to keep their feelings inside and to isolate. And it led to some serious issues with me where, there was a suicide attempt back in 1999 when I just felt that desperate and lost and hopeless and darkness. Thank God I screwed it up. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking today. But, back then, as I mentioned earlier, there was nowhere to go to talk about these issues. Today, athletes and celebrities are applauded. They're put on a pedestal. They're talked about how brave they are. I was one of the first people who walked off of the ship in Normandy as a mental health person and got fired at from every angle possible. And it was a very sad, deadly time for me.
Looking back, Michael, would you have done anything differently?
Looking back, looking back, I would have minded stayed in New York and stayed at HBO and kept my, I didn't realize the amount of work and the toll that building a network was going to take. Unfortunately, back in the 90s, there weren't places to go for people with mental health. I wasn't treated. I wasn't under the right medication. There are so many wonderful things about the Golf Channel that I'll always be attached with. But the one of the sad ones is that it almost cost me my life. And I don't know if that's worth any billion-dollar business. But fortunately for me, many of us have to fall really hard before we're able to reach out and figure out what was going on. So it enabled me to seek the professional help that I think everybody should do when they're feeling the way that I was feeling, because it was quickly diagnosed that for 40 years of my life, I had been suffering from severe bipolar disorder. My highs were, I mean, if you remember the show, the movie, A Beautiful Mind with John Nash, the brilliant mathematician, he bounced around like a ping pong ball. And that was kind of like me at the Golf Channel, always being, in a position that I had to be on 100% of the time. I had to worry about too many people. I was never able to go any place and talk about the fears that I had. So I kept everything inside for 4 or 5 years. And like a pressure cooker, if you don't let out the steam, it finally explodes. And that's kind of what happened. And I was the baby thrown out with the bathwater at the time. And I had to learn how to reinvent myself.
So now you are struggling for your life in a different way. I know you've documented your battle with cancer for a while now on social media. How are you, and what's your prognosis?
Well, today's a good day. Back in 2010 was the first time I was diagnosed with cancer, and that was prostate cancer. We got through that, and then I developed a serious respiratory illness that caused me some problems. But the big blow came in 2022 when I got a CT scan for a bad back. And when I went to my pain management specialist, they said that, yeah, your back's still in bad shape, but oh, by the way, there's a huge lump in your neck. And I was just completely caught off guard because at the time I didn't know it was there. I didn't feel ill. But after another MRI and seeing an oncologist, they realized that I had stage four head and neck cancer. So in August 1st of 2020, I was operated on, spent the next 18 months going through various treatments for cancer. And, today we show no evidence of disease, which is a great thing for today. But unfortunately, most cancer patients, it's not always the cancer, it's a lot of the collateral damage that the cancer does. So I've been having a lot of challenges in the last year with digestive esophageal problems where I'm not able to eat or swallow or talk for long periods of time. My voice more often sounds like a 90-year-old smoker than it does today. So because of the inability to swallow and to eat, I'm going back into the hospital on Wednesday, May 1st, and we're gonna do some more biopsies and we're gonna do another endoscopy to see, making sure one that the cancer from my head and neck has not metastasized to my throat. And if that's the case, which I'm hoping it is, then what is the problem that's not allowing me to swallow or to eat any longer? So a cancer patient kind of goes through these things every single day. I mean, anytime you get a cough or a sneeze or you don't feel well, your first thought is that it's back. Oh my God. And you spend most of your time going to doctor's appointments and treatments and just making sure that you're around to fight another day. So, that's where I am. Today I feel relatively well, but I've got a bad immune system, and when you do that, you're prone to infections and you're prone to secondary problems. And but I'm a warrior. I talk about, my never ever give up Jill Valvano saying. I have great support from the cancer community. I'm a cancer advocate, and being a great athlete like you were, it's taught us to prepare for playing through pain and being prepared for challenging times. And so I look forward to finding out what's wrong with me and moving on.
Well, your strength and resilience is unbelievable, Michael. You inspire so many people. You have a great following on social media because you're so honest and open about what your struggles have been, both with your cancer and with mental health. And it must feel somewhat good to be able to inspire so many people who are experiencing perhaps the same things that you are.
I got onto Twitter years ago, and I got onto Twitter because I thought people wanted to listen or hear about sports television and my creation of the Golf Channel. That's the only reason that I got on Twitter. And I did not have a very huge following, and some people were interested, but it was insignificant. And then when I switched gears and started to talk about mental health issues and cancer, and I started to become an advocate, and I started to have a voice for those around the world who didn't have a voice, who didn't know how to articulate how they felt. It was amazing that overnight, my whole life changed, and it changed in the sense that, you know, thousands of people worldwide, I was serving a purpose for. And I think that most of us who go through depression, most of us who feel lonely, most of us who go through these challenging times, my words of advice is, you know, reach out and give back and pay it forward and help somebody on that day. And you'll be amazed how much better you feel and what a difference that you can make. So that's what I did. I created sort of the cancer update page. And, you know, it gets 2 or 3 million impressions a week from around the world of people that are going through similar issues that I am. It's doctors, nurses, patients, family members that finally have a place where they can go and talk about what's going on behind closed doors of their life. And it's been extremely rewarding for me, and it's been my home. And it's a place, like you said, it's raw. It's, you know, I talk about it, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and I post pictures, and I wake up every day trying to make the world a better place. And if I can do no good, please allow me to do no harm.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Your journey is full of the good, the bad, and the ugly, the ups and the downs. What else can people learn from the journey that you have had and continue to have?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that, and it's no matter what it is in life, is that, you know, silence will destroy you. No sunshine will kill every beautiful plant in your garden. And I think that was, you know, what haunted me for so many years. You know, my biggest mistake is that I didn't realize that the more you put it out there, the better one feels. The support you get is tremendous. And that, you know, you can have a life being a mental health person. You can have a life suffering from depression and bipolar disorder. A stage 4 cancer diagnosis is not a death sentence. There's no expiration date stamped on my rear end. So every single day I get up, some days are harder than others, and do my best to fight an entire 12 round championship fight against my most formidable foe. And I always go into the ring expecting that I'm going to be the victor at the end of when the bell rings.
You're a winner, Michael Whalen. I thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and I pray that you'll be around for a long, long time to continue to do so. Thanks so much for being on Golf Interview with Ann Liguori. My thanks to Michael Whalen and to Mike Goodsell in production. As the late, great Robin Williams once said, in quotes, "Everyone you meet is fighting a battle you know nothing about. Be kind, always." See you next time on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.